What's on this month in the world of arts and entertainment with Suzanne Hunter?
Hello, this is Steve Hogarth from Marillion on Suzanne Hunter's World of Arts and Entertainment.
Now, it's a real pleasure to welcome onto the show Steve Hogarth. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Now, do you think we're arts or entertainment? I think we're probably nearer to the arts than we are to entertainment.
Oh, I don't know. I think a bit of both. It's art, high form art.
I'll try and be entertaining anyway.
Oh, of course you will. Now, because legions of fans know all about the name of the band, took its inspiration from a book by J.R.R. Tolkien. But I was wondering how you found inspiration to be a musician and a singer in the first place.
First of all, when I was very young, my dad was in the Navy, which meant that he left my mum on her own with me quite a lot. And mm-hmm. so I think she combated the loneliness by constantly having the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was the Beatles on the radio, and we used to sing the Beatles songs together, me and my mum. And so the Beatles became my first love, really. I was never that bothered about Elvis or anything that went before the Beatles, but the Beatles did it for me. And then after the Beatles, then hot on their heels came the Stones. I bought Not Fade Away by the Stones.
Oh, yeah, brilliant.
And then the Kinks. I bought Tired of Waiting for You by the Kinks.
Oh.
So the Beatles, the Stones, the Kinks. And then a few years passed and I discovered The Who.
Mm-hmm.
And the first sort of proper band I ever saw live when I was about 17 or 16 or something was Deep Purple, and I saw them at Sheffield City Hall, and they were playing their Machine Head album, which was the one with the smoke on the wall and all of that.
Oh, yes.
And I remember sitting in Sheffield City Hall totally mesmerized by Deep Purple, and the thing you can forget now, you know, it was all such a long time ago, was that they were making noises that no one had ever made. I mean, there was never an organ sound like their organ sound, and there was never a guitar sound like Richie's sound, and there was never a singer that sang like Ian Gillan. And all those things have now become sort of a little bit part of what a stereotypical rock or heavy rock band should sound like.
Yeah.
But of course, they'd invented that, probably without trying. And they weren't listening to heavy rock because it didn't exist. They were listening to blues and, and rhythm and blues and jazz. But then they'd kind of unwittingly created this new music.
Yeah.
So because I'd never heard that before, and because of the general energy that they were putting out on the stage, I remember just sitting there at Sheffield City Hall thinking, well, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's better than this, is it? This is what I should be doing.
Yeah, you thought this is the rock and roll life for me.
Surely everything else is worse. Therefore, wouldn't I be a fool to do anything else?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, what a wonderful life it is. And like you say, I mean, the Beatles very much, sort of exemplify the whole start, really, don't they? And then, of course, the Stones with their blues, they were influenced by blues. And then it all sort of rolls into that whole great rock and roll, you know, tradition, isn't it? So it was amazing.
Well, the Beatles were amazing because they started out, you know, as a very straight-ahead pop group, singing twee little pop songs about, you know, being in love.
Mm.
And, you know, my girl done me wrong, or this is the girl for me. And in no time at all, really, in just a few years, they ran the gamut. You know, they created concept albums.
Oh, definitely. I'm the Walrus came about.
Yeah, and Strawberry Fields Forever, and then side two of I remember playing side two of Abbey Road over and over again and being totally mesmerized by the way it was sort of like a symphony. You know, and since then, that kind of music has been called progressive rock, and it's been called this, that, and the other.
Yes.
The fact was, the Beatles kind of invented that as well.
Absolutely, yeah, that whole psychedelic side of things as well.
Psychedelia, and then it's more sort of conceptual approach. And then I got dragged along by a friend to Manchester to see The Who one night, and I found them thoroughly inspirational, and that they probably had more to do with my approach to what you should do when you play live than any other band, you know, because they used to come on stage as though their lives depended on it, as though they were at war.
Mm.
And the feeling of adrenaline that I got straight off them, just by the very the commitment they had to what they were about to do, was just so adrenalizing.
Yeah.
And I always remember, I always think about The Who, you know, before I go on stage, if you can be half as committed to an audience as they were, you're doing all right.
Oh, absolutely. You're not going to swing your microphone around too much, though, are you?
Well, no, you know, we all have our own way of doing it.
Yeah.
But it was all about commitment.
Mm, definitely. I mean, you're certainly committed because, as well as a vocalist, you also play the keyboards. Have you found that a very sort of useful tool in songwriting, and does it help you when you're writing a piece?
Yes. Yeah, well, obviously, being able to sort of sit down and understand the language, you know, and know what an F minor 7 is and you know, or what a D sus 4 is, to be able to translate that language and add to it is useful. I mean, you could argue it'd be just as useful not to understand it at all, because then you wouldn't fall into the well-trodden paths of music. You'd be more experimental, and it really would be all about the sound. Mm-hmm. And I think really in a kind of about half and half with that.
Mm-hmm.
None of us are musically trained, so it's not like we sit down with dots and lines or anything. But we know enough music to talk the language, but we don't know so much that we fall into the kind of furrows of accepted musical rules. You know, we still have enough ignorance to be experimental.
It's good to keep expanding those horizons, isn't it, really?
I mean, yeah, well, we write most of our stuff by jamming, and we record everything, and we get into a room and we jam together, and I'm usually sitting there with a laptop with lyrics on the screen and trying to work out if I can hang a tune on any of the jams, if I can hang the words on any of the jams. And 90% of the time, maybe 99% of the time, it doesn't really work out, and it all gets thrown away, but there is that magic 1% where the happy accidents happen, and you play something back and you go, oh, hang on, there was 10 seconds of something really interesting there that was like nothing we've ever done and not really like anything we've ever heard. Let's work on that and try and make that into a song. And to work like that, it's very time-consuming and can be a bit frustrating, but what you get in return for it is the possibility of expanding into a new place, a place you wouldn't naturally go.
No, that's right, isn't it? It's when you're doing something creatively like that and you're just sort of just going with the flow. Sometimes, like you said, you allow for that sort of moment of, oh, I didn't think that was going to come. And, you know, but like you said, it can be quite a long process doing that. But, yeah, definitely worth it for those moments of that one moment that you get.
Yeah, we typically, you know, take a couple of years to get songs together. And that's not necessarily just because we're bone idle, although we are bone idle. It's also because of that process.
Yeah, exactly. If something's worth waiting for, you know, you've got to spend the time on it, haven't you?
Well, yeah. Like the prettiest girls, you know, will always keep you waiting that extra hour because they know they're worth
it. Exactly, because they're worth it. I mean, your first album with Marillion was Season's End, which was obviously a resounding success. And you've had so many other successes, including solo albums, and also you play in the H Band, your own band, with many different musicians. Why do you like to have the two on the go? Do you sort of like the freedom and also the variety?
Well, I found after a few years of Marillion, I found my pipes getting a bit clogged with ideas that they hadn't wanted to develop, you know, that they didn't feel was right for them. And so getting away from them and getting those things out of my system was a relief and really helped when I came back to the band. And I tried to assemble a band and some music that would be a long way away from Marillion. So, I phoned up Clem Burke from Blondie, and he came and played drums on it, and Dave from XTC came and played guitar on it, and Richard from Japan played synthesizers, and Chucho, who'd worked a lot with the Eurythmics, and then later Andy Ganganeen, who'd worked with Massive Attack a lot. So I'd got all these really interesting musicians that were in completely different areas of music to what you might associate me with, and got right away from Marillion, and then toured with them, and you know, had a really good time away. And then I did find when I came back to the band, feeling really fresh and really ready to create again with them. And also much more appreciative of the musical talents within Marillion, having been and worked with people that were totally different.
Yeah, sort of a renewed vigour.
Yeah, renewed vigour and renewed respect as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, obviously, you do sound like you're somebody who likes to do diverse things, because we started off the interview talking about the Tolkien book, but I believe you've penned two volumes of diaries as well, released in June.
Oh, I was hoping you'd mention them.
There you go. On cue.
I have, yeah. Well, way back in 92, I'd been in Iceland recording a video, making a video for Marillion's Dry Land song. And I'd been on the top of mountains and walking along glaciers and helicoptered into ravines and God knows what. And I came home to England and went and saw my mum and dad. And my dad said, "What have you been up to, son?" And I said, "Oh, I've been in Iceland, you know, and I was helicoptered onto the top of this mountain, and I was on this glacier, and then I went to this party, and I met this girl called Björk, who's in this band called the Sugar Cubes, and then I came home, and I ran into Julian Lennon in the pub, and he just said, 'Stop right there.' He said, 'You should keep a diary, you know, because there's stuff happening to you that doesn't really happen to people.' So I promised him I'd do it, and I began writing out what happened in my ordinary life, and sometimes that would be plumbing in the dishwasher at home, and sometimes it would be being in rehearsal in London and rubbing shoulders with Mick Jagger or Princess Stephanie of Monaco, and sometimes that would all happen in the same day. You know, I'd plumb the dishwasher in the morning, and I'd be walking past Iggy Pop in the corridor in the afternoon.
The ordinary to the extraordinary. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
Wow, these things do happen, though, don't they? It's fabulous, the diversity. You never know what's around the corner. That's a great thing.
Well, I think that's what comes across in the diaries, that you know, here's someone who puts his, you know, maybe baths his kids at night and puts his kids to bed, reads them a story, and then gets up the following morning and flies to Mexico City.
Did you find it was quite some? Did you find writing came to you quite easily? You inspired?
What, the writing?
Mm.
Well, it was only it wasn't a question of inspiration. It was more a question of just having the discipline to sit down and write what had happened in the day.
Mm.
You know,
yes.
So because it's a diary, there's no fiction in there. It's just what happened.
Yeah,
and I would try to write it in the evening that it had happened, you know, so that it was fresh,
yeah.
So that the details of it were fresh. But then sometimes I didn't write anything, you know. Sometimes we'd be in a chateau in France making an album or something, and I'd be so busy working on the record I wouldn't have time to write anything, which I regret a little bit, because some of those experiences would have been really worth writing down. But sometimes there just isn't the hours in the day to do it.
No, there's always volume three.
There's always, well, if I did a volume three, it'd probably be reminiscences, you know, and writing down what I can remember of what happened that I never really wrote down, because there have been a few. Mine is quite a lot of it's best forgotten, I think.
Or not repeated aloud.
Exactly.
No, because obviously writing, you know, you've written some fabulous songs as well, and you've great news for fans is you've got a new album out. Tell us a little bit about that, and also the main single and inspiration behind that.
Well, which album are we talking about? Because there isn't a brand new album out at the moment. We're working at the moment on a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And our last album is called Sounds That Can't Be Made.
Yeah.
Did we release a single? I didn't even know if we had. I don't think we did, unless there's one I've forgotten about.
Oh, well, I'll be playing Power, so I'm going to go for that.
Oh, that's true.
Glad I'm here.
I'll start again. Yes, we've got a new album out called Sounds That Can't Be Made. Albums That Can't Be Remembered.
Yeah. That's the next one.
it's been out a year or so now, so
great.
It's not, when I say it's new, it's not, it's, you know, It's reborn. Probably needs polishing to be brand new again.
Yeah.
And we've already toured with it. We've toured around the world with it. Mm-hmm. But it's been very well received by the fans, and a lot of people are saying it's our best work for many, many years.
Yeah.
I'm still a bit too close to it to know, to be honest. I mean, they're all like children to me, so I can't,
of course,
can't
yeah.
really choose between them. Yeah, there's the lead track from the album is called Power, which is a song about what power really is. You know, I guess power of love, really, how that compares to what we normally think of as power and how it eclipses it.
Mm, that's right, yeah. It's all power trip as opposed to the power of love, sort of universal. Such
yeah.
a great big emotion, isn't it, really?
It is, and I think you can fall in love and it's like a bomb going off inside you, and from that moment forward, you know, everything that you thought of in the past as powerful or energetic or being fundamental to you can be just swept to one side.
That's lovely, isn't it? Lovely, lovely notion there. I mean, fans are going to be, you know, as I say, they are in for a treat. They're going to get to hear quite a number of your classics. I guess you're also going to play some of the previous album, The Sounds That Can't Be Made. What can audiences expect in the upcoming tour?
Well, this is a Christmas tour we're about to embark upon here in the UK. So we've hung on, you know, till December to put it together so that everyone's kind of getting a Christmas feeling. So we've designed this tour as a bit of a Christmas party, really. And what we're going to try and do is pull out songs from across the band's catalogue, really, that are not too moody, a little more up-tempo, a little more celebrational in their vibe, and to keep the mood up. And then once we get to the encores, you know, then it really will be as Christmassy as we can make it, and probably quite goofy.
Sounds good. Sounds good fun. Sounds diverse anyway, doesn't it? I mean, you're going to be up and down the country, and I believe you're stopping in London on the 11th of December at the Forum Kentish Town.
So, the fabulous Forum, yeah. Best gig in London.
Yeah, you're looking forward to getting back there?
Yes, it's always great there. I really like it as a venue to both to play and to see a band.
Oh, that's great, isn't it? Great atmosphere, proper live music venue. I mean, very good luck with the tour and with the album. And it just remains me to say thank you very much for being on the show, Steve.
Suzanne, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too. Now, that was Steve Hogarth from Marillion, and he's currently on tour, and he's going to be at the Forum Kentish Town on the 11th of December.
Go to www.mamacolive.com/theforum and be sure to find out where else they're playing, www.marillion.com.
Suzanne Hunter bringing you the world of arts and entertainment in Surrey and beyond on Brooklyn's Radio. Radio.